This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk. Hello and welcome back to Market Talk. Refreshed after our summer break, we've got a bumper episode today. From the Federal Reserve to France and from China to currency calls, let's connect the dots to reveal what's been driving markets. My name's Harry Brooks. I'm a content manager in L&G's asset management business. And I'm joined today by Ben Bennett, Head of Investment Strategy Asia, who as usual joins us from Hong Kong. How have you been, Ben?
Yeah, I haven't actually had a holiday this August. Oh. Well, I was back in the UK in June, I guess. I was early, but I've had a few friends visiting, so they must have been on holidays. And I was in Bangkok last week with work, and I'm going to Tokyo next week, first time ever in proper Japan. So that's going to be exciting.
Yeah, exciting. Just tell us how it is when you come back. Well, let's dive straight into it with the latest drama at the US Federal Reserve. President Trump's been very vocal, of course, in his dissatisfaction with Fed Chair Jay Powell over the past few months. But last week, a less well-known figure from the central bank came under pressure. Can you give us a quick summary of what's been going on and how it's affecting the way that markets think about the independence of the Fed?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? There's all these things that flare up and we all suddenly have to become experts on the intricacies of governing bodies and all that sort of stuff. So this time around, as you say, it's the Federal Reserve in the US. There are seven members of the Board of Governors, so they're sort of permanent voters for federal rate cuts, seven of them. And then they're augmented by five other voters who are sort of they're five of the 12 of the governors of the regional boards, and they sort of take it in turns to vote. But the key members of these seven members of the Board of Governors at the Federal Reserve, one of whom is Jerome Powell, who's the chair, Jay Powell, he's the chair. Another is a woman called Lisa Cook. But the concern, or that maybe investors are thinking perhaps that President Trump is trying to replace Lisa Cook with someone who he could then get to vote his way of thinking, you would need to get four of those seven of the Board of Governors. So this is not, I'm not talking about changing rate policy, because like I said, there's those seven plus five others, there's 12 members, but actually just to change the way that the Federal Reserve works, you just need those seven members to vote 4-3. So you need four of them really to really change to change the way the Federal Reserve can work. You know, what are they targeting in terms of inflation? They could even change the way that the number of voters for the other five members can vote. So it's really important. He's already got one who's going through sign off by the Senate. President Trump can nominate, but they have to be signed off by the Senate. He's got one going through. If he can replace Lisa Cook, that would be two. We know next year that Jerome Powell will relinquish his chairmanship in May next year. Doesn't necessarily have to leave the board, but normally he would leave the board. So that could be three. So you could start to see how you could get four. And at that point, that becomes an issue for investors, because the whole way that the Federal Reserve votes and does things could change.
So these figures who you may not be so familiar with could become increasingly important, probably hear more about them in the months ahead. Last time we caught up, we talked about the difference between the yield in the 30-year US government bond and the 2-year. And you noted that there's a trend of the gap between those two increasing. I looked at the updated chart that you shared earlier this week, and it looks like that trend is carrying on. Has the political drama around the US central bank played a part in that, and how do we see this playing out for investors?
Absolutely. And when I mentioned investors are interested in what's going on here, it's really being seen in this curve shape in the US, also in the value of the dollar is the other way that you can think about it. And the reason is because, okay, the Federal Reserve can set short-term interest rates, and that can drive up and down, say, you know, one-year rates, two-year government bond yields. But when you look further along the curve, that's thinking about where central bank policy rates might be in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years' time, and all the way through to 30 at the long end, right? And that's a function of how confident investors are about how the governance is going to be. And by governance, I mean, how well are they going to control inflation? I mean, that's a crucial part of where interest rates are going to be. If inflation shoots higher by desire or by accident, then usually interest rates go higher. So if you're less confident that the Federal Reserve is going to be all over inflation, is going to be controlling inflation, then you see longer dated yields going up. And there's also a function of volatility. Look, I mean, if you're uncertain about how policy is going to be set, uncertain about who's going to say what, who's going to threaten what, then as an investor, you probably also want a little bit more risk premium. You want a little bit extra yield to reward you for taking on that volatility. So again, that tends to drive longer dated yields up. And we have seen this. It all adds up to a risk premium. We've seen US 30-year yields increase over time up to, say, 5%, even as shorter dated yields are falling because investors are more confident that we're going to get maybe rate cuts in the near term. But those long dated yields are going up. It's not just the US, though. It's everywhere. This is going on all over the place. And this week we've seen headlines, haven't we, about the UK yields going up, and their 30-year government bond yields are up 5.75%. Last time I looked, we're talking today on Wednesday, the 3rd of September. So these yields are moving around a lot. So there is a risk premium being found in lots of these bond markets. And the yield curve, like I said, is one area that you're seeing that.
Thanks. That's a useful way of thinking about it, a sort of risk or uncertainty premium that you're seeing at the longer end. So sticking with politics, but shifting continents, the political risk premium in France has been in the spotlight with a crucial vote that's coming up on Monday. This time around, it's a confidence vote rather than a no confidence vote like the one we saw at the end of last year, which led to the departure of President Macron's previous PM. What's the difference between the two? And what would a loss for France's current minority government mean?
Yeah, this fits in under the same category as something we didn't really know a lot about until recently. Mm. And now we're starting to find stuff out about it. So, yeah, you're right. There's a technicality here. So a confidence vote is harder to win than a no confidence vote. In effect, a no confidence vote, you need a majority to vote you out, whereas a confidence vote, you need a majority to keep you in. So if you just don't vote, if you abstain, it doesn't help you in a confidence vote. So you need to have opposition parties. And remember, in France, after the recent, well, it was a year ago, and just over a year ago, which is also important, I'll get back to that. Just over a year ago, there was an election and Macron's party lost its majority. So it's a minority role. It needs to have opposition parties vote for it in a confidence vote. And that doesn't look as though it's going to happen. A week is a long time in politics. This vote is coming up in a few days' time. So we'll see what's happening there. The crux of the matter is really back to what I was describing before. You know, this is uncertainty around deficit spending in France. A lot of countries have got a lot of debt. France has got a big budget deficit, trying to get it under control, which is pretty unpopular. No one wants to have higher taxes and lower spending, but unfortunately, that's pretty much a good way of getting a deficit down. So the opposition don't want this budget. So the government has called this confidence vote. If they lose the confidence vote, you've got a few different choices. You can try and go ahead with another prime minister. But, you know, this is just putting another face onto an unpopular policy. I don't see how that's going to change anything significantly. Or you can hold another election. And the previous issue is that you can't hold an election in France for the parliament within 12 months of the previous one. But now we've passed that 12-month threshold. We could see another election. And yeah, again, that's uncertain. How's that going to turn out? What's the population going to vote for?
So there's a strong thematic link here with this uncertainty risk premium and how it affects bond markets. So as you might expect, based on everything you just described, we've seen the yield on French government debt rising, and spreads, I believe, over German debt are now pretty similar to that you'd see with Italy, which isn't historically what you'd expect. Italy, you'd expect to be a bigger spread. The rise also means that the spread on French government debt is increasingly in line with investment grade credit. I'm conscious that previous episodes of political instability or heightened instability in France have presented opportunities for investors. Could this be another one?
Yeah. So, okay. So there's a load of stuff going on, I think, is the best way of putting it. So as you said, when you've got this uncertainty, you generally see yields going up. So we can see that in the US from a yield curve shape. In Europe, you can see it because you look at where the yield of, say, French government 10-year bonds are trading versus German 10-year bonds. And you assume that Germany is the risk-free level, which is not actually necessarily the case either. I mean, Germany has also got its issues in terms of high deficit spending, spending money for the defense sector, etc. So yeah, it's not clear that that's the case, but at least you're looking at 10-year French government bond yields versus German, which they're about 80 basis points, so 0.8% higher in France. You're having to pay 0.8% more yield if you're French government than the German. And then you look at, as you said earlier, the sort of poster child of the European crisis of a few years ago of Italy, and where their bonds trade versus the German bonds. And they trade at maybe 90 basis points over 0.9% higher than Germany. Not a lot between France and Italy at that point. Back in the Euro crisis, Italian government bond yields were 5 percentage points higher than Germany. So that was a huge wedge, wasn't it, back then? Whereas France got us up to, I think it was a little bit under 2%. So, yeah, it was still a decent premium over Germany, but it was really Italy there was an issue. And look, this is an interesting point, I think, at this stage, because, okay, right now France is in the headlines, politics isn't going very well, everyone is looking at the deficit. But it's not just France. I mentioned Germany's got a big deficit. Italy has got a big deficit, and also politically has always had a lot of volatility over the years. So it's at times like this, as an investor, we have to take a step back and try and be sober about this. And, you know, perhaps the country where the focus is on right now, say France, where yields have started to increase, perhaps it's interesting to start to add to some French risk at this point, because you know that at some point it's going to be Italy or the UK or whoever it might be next who will be under the spotlight. And at that time, maybe those French yields will start to decline. You can make money out of having bought those French bonds. And watch other, you know, maybe Italian bond yields start to go up and wait for that to happen and then nibble at those Italian bond yields. So, yeah, it's not just a French issue. It's all over the place. And perhaps it's worthwhile just having a look at those extra yields, and they can be potentially attractive, because, frankly, right now, there's very few places to hide. There's a lot of governments under pressure.
Of course, yeah. Politics is also shaping the outlook for China, as you'd expect, with US tariffs adding a significant layer of uncertainty to uncertainties that we talked about last year and in years before that. Yet this year, performance of Chinese equity markets has been pretty strong, I understand. What have been the main drivers here?
There's been a lot of drivers. I think I was actually in Shenzhen, just across the border in mainland China, earlier this week at a conference. And it was interesting to hear the way that people were perceiving China today compared to last year. You know, last year, the Chinese economy was quite weak. Equity markets were quite poor, facing potentially uncertainty as President Trump got elected towards the end of last year. You know, what was going to, is he going to be anti-China? And the like I said, the perception is actually that a lot of the tariffs that President Trump has unleashed is not necessarily anti-China. There's lots of countries have been impacted by this, and actually China has been able to stand up to some degree and use the fact that it's a big consumer market, massive manufacturing. We all know about these rare earth exports that they've been able to control, in order potentially to get better negotiating ability at the table. So that has actually been, if anything, on a relative basis, quite a positive for Chinese markets. And at the same time, you know, the Chinese economy is slowly shifting away from the addiction to debt, the addiction to the property markets, prices going up. That's in the middle of a reset. And there's a focus, isn't there, on more growth areas and the technology sector. Again, at this conference, outside the conference center, some of the cars that were on display there to show, just incredible amounts of technology and the way that they are developing that sector. So, yeah, the Hang Seng, which is the Hong Kong market, is up a lot this year, up until yesterday. So that'll be Tuesday, the 2nd of September, up 27%. there's a lot of money being raised from mainland China companies who are issuing IPOs in the Hong Kong market, and those IPOs are doing well. We've got the DeepSeek at the start of this year also adding to that positive momentum. And there's also tremendous demand from mainland investors coming into Hong Kong and buying the Hang Seng. So Hang Seng has done really well. Now, the onshore markets, so this is headlined by the CSI 300, which is an onshore index, they have lagged for much of this year. They had a bigger wobble when the Liberation Day tariffs were announced, and then they had lagged a decent amount. But they've had a great run just recently. Since the end of July, they're up about 10%, the CSI 300. So that's been a boost. Now, it's still lagging the Hang Seng. It's up maybe only 14, 15% so far this year compared to 27% for the Hang Seng, but it's done pretty well. I did hear one interest just this morning, actually. I was out meeting investors, and one interesting thought was that possibly there was a boost there to coincide with the big political events that are taking place in Beijing this week, particularly the parade for the end of the Second World War. Maybe there was a design to make sure that the markets were strong up until that point. But I actually think there's some reasonable fundamental justification for that move.
I wonder how many investors would have predicted that this is where we'd be with China in terms of performance at this point of the year. I guess perhaps not many. So sticking with roughly that part of the world, I also want to touch on India in the context of the 50% US tariff on imports from the country that were imposed last week. The rupee following that hit its lowest level against the dollar. I'm interested in the options facing the Reserve Bank of India from here. On the one hand, I can see an obvious case for defending the rupee to keep inflation under control and maintain investor confidence, prevent further outflows. At the same time, I guess a weaker rupee should help the exporters that will bear the brunt of the US tariffs. So which path do you think the bank might choose from here?
And India is so interesting in this whole geopolitical concept, and also it's an interesting case in point, as you mentioned before, in terms of what is the central bank doing. So, I mean, we've got a lot of central banks in the developed markets that are happy to see inflation falling slowly. They're cutting interest rates, but deficits are massive. Generally in emerging markets, the central banks got inflation under control a bit quicker. Emerging markets are more used to funding crises and sorting them out. And central banks are very much on top of this in general. So they hiked interest rates and they've got inflation under control. In India, inflation is under control. It's actually falling. Food inflation is very important there. The monsoon season is really important. But so far, it's looking pretty under control. And the domestic economy is going very well. PMIs, which are the ways that we look at sentiment in terms of manufacturing service sector sentiment across the world. Well, the ones in India are in the 60s, which are amazingly strong. I mean, most of the other parts of the world are just trying to fight to get them at 50. So 50 is a sort of break-even level. It's out of 100, right? So 50 break-even. But in India, 60s, it's amazing. So inflation falling, very strong economy. What's not to like? And then you come back to the tariffs and you come back to the external vulnerability. So, yeah, India has not been able to make a deal with President Trump yet for whatever reason. India, very, very strong agricultural sector. And whereas President Trump, I think, would like to see some of the barriers to that agricultural sector broken down. But that's very, very hard to do if you're the Prime Minister of India to agree to do that. So they haven't got a deal yet. Trump is threatening 50% tariffs, which is not great. India is also very susceptible to importing energy. We know they're importing Russian energy. Russian oil, that's something that President Trump has said he does not want to see, and it's threatening more tariffs. And it's that external vulnerability that's leading to a weaker currency. And we have seen that currency weaken. And you're quite right. The Reserve Bank of India, the Central Bank of India, has got this in the back of their minds. They would like to cut interest rates because, honestly, inflation is falling, and maybe they will cut interest rates, but they don't want to cut interest rates and encourage even more capital to leave India and to put the currency under pressure. You're right that the weaker currency is good for the exporters, but it's not good for inflation. If you start to import inflation because of a weaker currency, everything's more expensive with a weaker currency that you're importing. That's not a good sign. So it's a difficult balancing act. My feeling is that they won't cut interest rates at the next meeting, but they could do. And for all the reasons I suggested before, if they take that bias, they could cut interest rates. I think they'll be cautious. This emerging market central banks have generally been a bit more cautious, keeping interest rates a bit higher, but we will see.
Understood. A balancing act, as always. Well, we've reached that point again, Ben. What is your number of the week for us today?
Yes, I was going to talk. It was basically the balancing act of the most important central banks, the Federal Reserve. So my number of the week is 75,000, and it's 75,000 jobs. And this is Friday's data out of the US, which will be the monthly payroll job creation data. 75,000 is roughly the number of jobs that were created in the last report that was about a month ago that caused a bit of a hoo-ha back then. And it's also the expectation for the number out on Friday for the number of jobs that were created in the previous month. So 75,000 is roughly what we expect. The reason why it's important is because the last monthly report had big downward revisions to earlier months, which suggested that the US economy was not as bright as it was once thought. And that's leading to expectations that the Federal Reserve is going to cut interest rates when they next meet on the 17th of September. And this is independent of all the shenanigans going on in terms of the governors, etc. The 17th of September, the meeting, then they are expected to cut interest rates. But Friday's payroll report is probably the most important data point to determine whether or not they do. The data has been revised so much, it's so hard to predict, that who knows what the number is. If it's a really, really big number, a really strong number, they probably won't cut in September. If it's a weak number, they might even cut by 50 basis points in September. So the all investors' eyes are glued on this number on Friday to see if it is 75,000 or if it's 375 or minus 75. Let's see.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk about that number when we catch up again in just a couple of weeks' time, and we'll be eagerly awaiting that interest rate decision and talking about that as well. Of course, thanks so much for your time today, Ben, and thanks to all our listeners too.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against L&G in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information. Not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to L&G, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities, Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.